Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is the show called Getting It Done. I'm your host, Dr. Walter Dean. Things look real bad in our country today when it comes to those different six sicknesses that you can find in Texas and Florida and Georgia, Arizona, and California, and in South Carolina, for the most part. There's so many people in these hospitals, and the hospitals are getting overloaded. The top four states that I probably mentioned, I think, let me say them again. Texas, Florida, California, Arizona are the top four. Georgia comes in fifth. South Carolina comes in sixth, but South Carolina is not as bad as the others. Could it be that we are looking at the very end of life on the planet? Or should I say, life as we know it? Well, you know, the Bible tells you a lot of things about these different things that are getting ready to happen. So let's give a little listen to what's called Strange Things Happening. Open your eyes. It's in the Bible.
Strange things are happening. In the Bible, you can find all kinds of stories where things happen that people would consider strange. A man telling others that a great flood will destroy the world. I'm building an ark. That's a strange thing. A man saying God sent a whale to swallow me, but not kill me. Lot's wife looking back and turning into a pillar of salt. Those are strange things. Or how about a dead man named Lester coming back to life? Or a storm changing into calmness after the words, peace be still. Or three boys being cast into a fire, but they don't burn. In fact, they walk out without even smelling or smoke. These are strange things. Strange because science and the human mind find them unexplainable. But to us as believers, there is no other explanation than it being the work of God. Now, there's a question that has been at the forefront of many conversations in light of recent events. Are we living in the last days? Are we living in the last days? Because a lot of strange things are happening. But my brothers and sisters, I urge you, rather than look at each and every event that is currently happening in the world, rather than dissecting each and every theory out there, rather than focusing on every single unexplainable thing that is reported, my message to you is to focus on your personal relationship with Jesus Christ. Don't ignore what's happening around you or around the world. No, but your focus, your goal should be to make sure that nothing distracts you, nothing sways you, nothing interrupts you from building a personal relationship with God. Draw near to God, and He will draw near to you. The focus of our lives should be to make sure that our individual relationship with God are in good standing. If strange things are happening, let them happen. I'm good with God. If things that the world can't explain are happening, let them happen. I'm standing on the solid rock of ages who promises to always be with me and never forsake me. Now, let me tell you this. What we don't realize, what we sometimes forget, is that even when God does something for us, or when He is doing something for us, the enemy is always, ways trying to take it from us, trying to distract us, cause noise, cause an interruption, so that we can focus on everything but God. That's why there is a need for us to be sober and diligent, not fearful. Don't be fearful, because that spirit of fear is prevalent right now. Be sober and diligent. Keep your eyes on the prize, which is Jesus, not fear. Keep your eyes on God's word, not on every report that comes out with a new theory about what's going on in this world. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. The book of Isaiah 55, verse 6 says, "Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he is near." And I struggle to understand this. Seek God while he may be found. Call on him while he is near. What was that supposed to mean? Because it implies that there might come a time when God may not be found. And I wrestled with this verse for a long time, until God opened my eyes to 2 Corinthians 5, verse 10. And it says, "For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one may receive the things done in the body, according to what he has done, whether good or bad." And when I read this, it started to make sense. Seek the Lord while he may be found, because we have the opportunity right now. Seek the Lord before your day of judgment comes. We have the opportunity to seek the Lord before our day of judgment comes. Because when we appear before that judgment seat of Christ, it's too late to try and build a personal relationship. You need to have established one already. When your name is called and you stand before the Master, it's too late to try and repent and try to live righteously. It's too late to try and build that personal relationship once again. Seek the Lord while he may be found. It's a word of warning that while you still can, call on God and build your personal relationship with him. Hear me, people of God. It's a serious thing when the Bible says each one may receive their reward according to what he has done, whether good or bad. So are you living for God? Are you sold out for Christ? Are you lukewarm, or are you burning with a holy desire? God checks the heart and not your words. He looks at the heart. So examine yourself. How are you living? What's in your heart? And remember that in Matthew 7, the Bible says, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' shall enter the kingdom of heaven." That's a verse that woke me up. It led me to examine my own heart, because we need not to be taken away by what we consider to be good works in our own lives, but rather we need to look to the Word of God for direction on how to live our lives in a way that's pleasing to God and in a way that benefits our relationship with him.
Don't wait until it's too late. Don't wait until you only have a few moments. Don't wait until your lungs are heavy and you're struggling to breathe. When you get here, it's too late. When you get here, there might not be enough time.
Well, I just wanted you to hear that presentation. It's very, very inspiring. And I thought it might be worthy of us being able to actually go back and think about what we've been doing with our life up to this particular point in time. Because, you see, as we go forward, there's a whole lot of things that are happening in our society today that just most often just blow me away. There's so many things, but there's a bigger crisis on all of the horizon, and this is something I think you might be very interested in hearing.
As most of the news talks about enforcing mandatory lockdowns and handing out money to citizens, there has been a problem that has been rapidly expanding in the background of all of this news. And it is a problem that the world has never really seen before. In fact, it might create a crisis that won't just be felt in the next week, the next month, or even the next year, but it might be felt for several decades to come. During World War II, Britain was in the thick of war against the Axis powers. However, Britain ran into a roadblock. They were quickly running out of money. So they began looking to borrow money from both their own future taxpayers as well as the United States and Canada. In 1941, Britain began accepting loans and taking on debt to fund the war. And by 1945, Britain had taken on nearly $10 billion worth of debt from its creditors. At this point in time, Britain's debt-to-GDP ratio was a whopping 200%, meaning that the country had twice as much debt as its entire market value of all of its goods and services it produces over an entire year. And just some perspective for you is that the World Bank states that once a country reaches above 77% debt-to-GDP ratio, its economy will begin to slow down from such a large portion of its revenue going towards paying down its own debt. So, after the war ended, Britain had amassed a debt that was so large that they couldn't pay back in 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, or even 20 years. You see, on December 29th, 2006, Britain made its last payment on its World War II debt to the United States and Canada. This means that British taxpayers from 1945 up until 2006 had a small portion of their tax bill every single year go towards the debt that the country accumulated in the 1940s. And for about a decade after World War II, Britain's economy was drastically hindered, in part due to their outstanding debt that they incurred. However, their economy eventually recovered thanks to an influx of taxpayers called the baby boomers, as well as some economic reforms and infrastructure investments. But you see, Britain was a little bit lucky. Most of the time, when a country accrues as much debt as Britain did during World War II, they are not so lucky. In 2001, Argentina's debt-to-GDP ratio reached a high of 166%, which caused the country to default on over $100 billion worth of debt. This default made capital move out of the country, and soon the nation saw millions of people enter poverty while unemployment reached a high of 19%. And to this day, Argentina still hasn't fully recovered from its debt crisis that it went through nearly 20 years ago. And similar stories can be heard around the globe. There was Greece in 2012, Zimbabwe in 2006, Venezuela in 2017, and Russia in 1998. The point I'm trying to make here is that even though debt can be a good thing to take on in order to solve today's serious problems, it will almost always have serious long-term consequences that could last for years or even decades. So now let's bring this back to the United States. Whether you know it or not, America essentially runs on debt. Historically, America's economy has been so big and has grown so fast that taking out tens of billions of dollars here or there hasn't really been much of a big deal because it was such a small percentage of the country's overall economy. For example, in 2006, the United States had a relatively healthy debt-to-GDP ratio of about 60%. But then, the financial crisis hit. And during the financial crisis, the United States began scrambling for ways to pump money into the economy. So it began taking out hundreds of billions of dollars and eventually trillions of dollars worth of debt. And some people might think that the United States, along with every other country that took out debt to get through the financial crisis, has paid off some of the debt that they accrued in 2008 and 2009. But actually, the opposite is true. You see, since the financial crisis, many developed countries throughout the world have been accruing more and more debt every single year while economic growth has slowed. This means...
So, I know you're wondering, what does this have to do with anything? If we're having people sick and we're in huge debt, there's going to be all kinds of turmoils going on. You can see it coming. where people are really going to be starving because of not being able to eat. And it's just, you can see it coming, and because of this sickness, many things could cause there to be a chain of reaction to cause things to continue to go bad. Now, this is just me talking, but let's listen to some predictions for the future.
Thank you so much. Now is the time to support the places you love. Hi, welcome to another Cold Fusion video. As everyone knows, from the perspective of humans, time only moves in one direction, and it's incredibly hard to predict the future. But over the years, there's been a select few who have managed to do this, and some managed to predict up to 100 years in the future with chilling accuracy. I wanted to do something fun for today's episode. So today, we'll take a look at some of these fascinating cases.
You're watching Cold Fusion TV.
Our first visionary needs no introduction. It's Nikola Tesla, a Serbian-American inventor, electrical engineer, mechanical engineer, and futurist, was instrumental in the development of AC power, motors, wireless communication, and too much to mention without bogging down this video. He stated the following. As early as 1898, I proposed to representatives of a large manufacturing concern the construction and public exhibition of an automobile carriage, which, left to itself, would perform a great variety of operations involving something akin to judgment. This description does sound something like a self-driving car. When they're navigating a road, they do have to make split-second decisions on how to proceed, which very well could be likened to a form of judgment. In 1926, Tesla also described wireless devices that would incorporate video and telephone technology and work over a network very much like the internet. Quote, when wireless is perfectly applied to the whole earth, we shall be able to communicate with one another instantly, irrespective of distance. Not only this, but through television and telephony, we shall see and hear one another as perfectly as though we were face to face, despite distances of thousands of miles. And the instruments through which we shall be able to do this will be amazingly simple compared to our present telephone. A man will be able to carry one in his vest pocket. End quote. This sounds a lot like video calling and smartphone communication. Of course, 100 years ago, simple long-distance calling didn't even exist. Tesla, once again, proves to be far ahead of his time. But he wasn't the only one. A lesser-known man by the name of John Watkins also made some startling predictions. In 1900, civil engineer John Watkins wrote a piece titled, What May Happen in the Next 100 Years? Within the article, Watkins made lots of predictions for the next century, and some ended up being amazingly accurate. Man will see around the world. Persons and things of all kinds will be brought within focus of cameras, connected electrically with screens at opposite ends of the circuits, thousands of miles at a span. This really could be likened to the internet and video sharing. Ready-cooked meals will be bought from an establishment similar to our bakeries today. In 1900, bakeries and butchers were some of the most common ways to get your food. There was no such thing as keeping it for a long time. Freeze-dried and packaged foods didn't exist, and neither did electric refrigerators. And one last one. Wireless telephone and telegraph circuits will span the world. A husband in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean will be able to converse with his wife sitting in her bedroom in Chicago. We will be able to telephone to China quite as readily as we can now talk from New York to Brooklyn. So surprisingly, Watkins had the same thinking as Tesla here. Unfortunately, he would die in 1903 before he saw a single one of his visions come to fruition. Unlike any of the other people in this episode, the next visionary actually inspired true inventions that affected all of our lives. American inventor and engineer Vannevar Bush designed influential analog computers during the 1920s and 30s. In 1922, he was one of the founders of the Raytheon Company. By the early 1940s, he was the most influential scientist in America, directing thousands of researchers and military generals, only answering to the president himself. He was even in charge of the atomic bomb. After the war, he wanted to turn all of the scientific efforts from destruction to peace. In this, he could force the academic knowledge being lost as time went on. With 1940s technology, there was simply no way to collect, organize, and access it all. His solution was nothing short of prophetic. In a 1945 article entitled, As We May Think, published in the Atlantic Monthly, Bush proposed a device that he called a Memex, Memex being short for memory extension. This device could store and connect information and thus work as an artificial aid to memory. He came to the conclusion that current systems organizing information by alphabetical order would be inadequate. A new system was needed, a system that was more flexible and should also work like the human brain. It would be a loose web of information connected by links between them. Quote, wholly new forms of encyclopedias will appear, ready-made with a mesh of associative trails running through them, ready to be dropped into the Memex and there amplified. Bush went on to describe the ability to retrieve several articles or pictures on a screen. He believed that people would create links between related articles, each user saving it for others to experience. In other words, people would create what we'd call websites today, where you can click on links and it takes you from one page to another. The Memex machine itself is what we'd call a desktop computer. There was much more in these writings, but I'm wary of this video's length, so I'll leave you with the sheer impact and the influence of Bush's writings. These writings directly inspired some of the co-creators of the internet in the 1960s. It also inspired the mouse, the Xerox Auto desktop computer in the 70s that inspired Steve Jobs. It also inspired the graphical user interface, and not to mention hyperlinks, the very backbone of the web. It truly had all the core ideas of the modern information age all the way back in 1945. If there was a visionary to fame ratio, Bush's would be sky high. He was one of the most influential people ever to have lived, but hardly anyone knows his name. Of course, apart from those who have read my book, New Thinking, Shameless Plug, in which his contributions and threads of influence throughout history and all of our lives was heavily focused on. In the art of predicting the future, there were also some companies that tried their hand. Philco was an early pioneer in electronics and were known for their radios. In 1967, for their 75th anniversary, they produced a short film speculating on life in the distant future. The film's title, The Year 1999 AD.
Fingertip shopping will be one of the many homemaker's conveniences. This video console will be channeled into the store of her choice. There, a camera will scan a display of wares, which she will select by push button. Another part of this console is a household monitor screen, which maintains a watch on critical areas in the house, swimming pool, or yard. What the wife selects on her console will be paid for by the husband at his counterpart console. All bills and transactions will be carried out electronically.
Oh, well, how about some golf at Pebble Beach Saturday afternoon?
Great. Anything to get out of here.
Right, hold on a minute. I don't know. The coast looks a little doubtful. There's a low moving in. Let me check Mexico City.
It's interesting to see the 1960s conceptions of online shopping and paying bills, electronic funds and transfers, and even communication between individuals anywhere in the world. And there's even some smart home elements in there, too. Our next prediction has a strange twist.
The only thing we can be sure of about the future is that it will be absolutely fantastic. So, if what I say now seems to you to be very reasonable, then I'll fail completely. Only if what I tell you appears absolutely unbelievable have we any chance of visualizing the future as it really will happen.
Famed science fiction author Arthur C. Clarke teamed up with Stanley Kubrick to make the film adaptation of the novel 2001: A Space Odyssey. In the 1968 film, two astronauts can be seen reading a newspaper on something that looks a little something like an iPad. The description of the device is especially amusing. Quote, when he had tired of official reports, he would plug his newspad into the ship's information circuit and scan the latest reports from Earth. One by one, he would conjure up the world's major electronic papers, which he could read with comfort. When he finished, he could flash back to the complete page and select a new subject for detailed examination. One could spend an entire lifetime doing nothing but absorbing the ever-changing flow of information from the new satellites. It kind of sounds like someone reading Twitter on an iPad. Now here's the twist. This description was so astonishingly accurate that Samsung used it to legally defend its Galaxy tablet when Apple sued for patent infringement.
If you're a man over 50 who suffers from arthritis, you need to see this.
Isaac Asimov was one of the world's most prolific science fiction writers, having written or edited 500 books over his four-decade career. The Russian-born writer was famous for books such as I, Robot. Naturally, his work contained many predictions about the future of science and technology. After visiting the World's Fair in 1964, he predicted the rise of cars with robot brains. Quote, much effort will be put into designing vehicles with robot brains, vehicles that can be set for particular destinations and that will then proceed there without any interference by the slow reflexes of the human driver. More than 50 years later, companies like Waymo, Tesla, and others are testing self-driving cars. Some of his other predictions in 1983 include, quote, a mobile computerized object that will penetrate the home, and the increasing complexity of society will make it impossible to live without this technology, end quote. I think that last point is especially insightful. Many people today think that society is indeed too complex to get by without it. He goes on to predict that computers will disrupt work habits and replace old jobs with ones that are radically different. This happened heavily from the 1980s into the end of the 20th century. During the 1988 interview, Isaac envisions the education of the future. He states that through computers, we'd have access to connected libraries, which would act as a teacher in the form of access to the gathered knowledge of the human species.
Thus, we have outlets, computer outlets in every home, each of them hooked up to enormous libraries where anyone can ask any question and be given answers, be given reference material, be something you're interested in knowing. From an early age, however silly it might seem to some of us, that's what you're interested in. And you ask, and you can find out, and you can follow it up. And you can do it in your own home, at your own speed, in your own direction, in your own time. Then everyone will enjoy learning.
Still, Asimov was wrong, or at least slightly wrong, on one thing, though. He predicted that technology would revolutionize education. And this is arguably correct, but he did go on to say that traditional schooling would become outdated as kids would be able to learn everything they needed to know from computers at home. That might be technically possible, but it also assumes that kids would spend all of their time using this technology to watch pointless videos or play Fortnite. Up next, we have a company that predicted their own future. In 1987, Apple made a promotional video entitled Knowledge Navigator, and a look to the future. Let's take a look.
Day party next Sunday.
Today, you have a faculty lunch at 12 o'clock. You need to take Kathy to the airport by 2. You have a lecture at 4:15 on deforestation in the Amazon rainforest.
Right.
Excuse me. Jill Gilbert is calling back.
Great. Put it through.
Hi, Mike. What's up?
Aha. Is this one of your typical last-minute panics for lecture material?
No. That's not until,
4:15.
The tablet device that he's talking to could be seen as an early imagination of an iPad. The interaction itself with the talking head is like Siri or Google Assistant. The command, show me my appointments, would do mostly the same thing. Show me my appointments.
You have 18 upcoming appointments. Here are the first three. All day Monday.
During his work, the professor takes a video call from a colleague. It appears in a separate window on the device. This could be Skype in a nutshell. Okay, so we have one more predictor of the future before we finish off.
Raymond?
My dad used to come home drunk every day and hit me. My mom had passed away from giving birth.
Kurzweil's life and career is pretty amazing. So if you want to see a full episode on him, let me know in the comments section below. In 1963, at age 15, he wrote his first computer program. It was pattern recognition software that analyzed the works of classical composers and then synthesized his own songs in a similar style. Admirable, even today, but absolutely unheard of in the 1960s. His inventions are numerous. Text reading software, speech recognition devices, and five of his novels have been bestsellers.
Just imagine you and I here. How I know it says. And be lost. But because of the technology, because of the innovation of speech synthesizers with these instruments, I can push the button, know what it's saying by listening to it say,
set recode button to start and stop recode. Sequencer activated. Recode no sequence.
He's currently the director of engineering at Google. In all of this, he's made dozens of predictions over the decades, with a pretty good track record. In the 80s, Kurzweil extrapolated improvements of computer software performance to predict that computers would beat a human chess player by the year 2000. In 1997, chess world champion Garry Kasparov was defeated by IBM's Deep Blue computer in a well-publicized chess match. During the late 80s, he predicted that the wireless internet would become practical for mainstream use in the early 21st century. In one of his books in 1999, he predicted e-books, face recognition software, and nanotechnology. And these are just a handful of examples. An evaluation in 2012 determined that Kurzweil's predictions have been correct an astonishing 86% of the time. Interestingly, in 2008, he told an expert engineering panel that solar power will scale up to produce all of the Earth's energy's needs in 20 years. According to him, we only need to capture 1/10,000th the energy from the sun that reaches the Earth's surface, and that apparently should supply all of our needs. We'll be waiting for this one. He did get some things wrong, though. Ray Kurzweil thought that the economy would continue to boom from the 1998 dot-com frenzy all the way through to 2009. He didn't see the dot-com crash coming, evidently. He also stated that by 2009, the majority of text would be created using continuous speech recognition. This is clearly not the case. But hey, an 86% success rate isn't too bad. So with that, it brings us to the end of the visionaries who correctly saw the future. It seems that to some of the greatest minds, there were some common threads, self-driving cars, an all-in-one pocketable communication device, and worldwide instant communication. It's almost like these things were inevitable. It's very interesting to think about. I'm sure a few of you out there would be thinking, so what? All of these predictions were easy. Well, in hindsight, definitely, but not so fast. In 1899, Charles Duell, the commissioner of the United States Patent Office, famously said, "Everything that can be invented has been invented." So it really takes some insight to get this right. So who was your favorite predictor of the future? Nikola Tesla predicting smartphones? John Watkins predicting modern life? Vannevar Bush conceptualizing the web and most of our modern life in 1945? The Philco Company predicting online shopping in 1967? 2001, A Space Odyssey predicting iPads in 1968? Isaac Asimov predicting computerization and robotics? Or Ray Kurzweil's many predictions during his life? Let me know in the comment section below. It's just amazing what the human mind can envision when imagination is combined with wisdom.
Wow. That to me was very, very interesting. That the minds today have the ability to do the things that are just unreal. I started off the program with predictions. Then I went to religions first. Then I talked about the predictions in terms of some of the crisis that we're going to be facing in terms of monies and debt and all of that thing. Then we're talking about the people who are actually were in visionaries and and inventors, to me, a lot of that is just, you'd have to be sort of in the midst of that whole thing. Let's see if I can find something else that's sort of very interesting. And this one is the something about how we have, you know, when you're talking about economics or sociology, you're talking about a structure that has individuals to live in a certain type of economy that's sometimes called upper class, middle class, low class. The low class, upper middle class, upper high class. And this one right here has something to do with those particular things and how they're broken down and how people are kept down. Let's listen to this.
Hi, this is Robert Kiyosaki, and I want to talk to you about an opportunity to learn to be an entrepreneur on the internet. Let me tell you something, as an old guy, you're the luckiest guy.
Do the rich people cringe and say, don't tell them that much?
Yes. Don't tell people what you know. My father was the head of education, PhD, all that stuff. I go home and ask him, so why don't we learn about money in school? And he looked at me and said, because the government doesn't let us teach that subject. Government tells us what we can teach and what we can't teach. I thought that was strange. And I said, but aren't we going to school to learn about money? He says, no, your job is to get a job. I said, but you get a job to earn money. He goes, no, you're supposed to just get a job. I went, no. Isn't the purpose of a job to earn money? He goes, you're correct. I said, so why don't we just learn about money? I can skip the job part, you know. And he got flustered and he said, if you want to learn about money, why don't you ask your best friend's father about money? And I said, why? That's Mike. So I asked him. He said, because Mike's father is an entrepreneur. And I said, what are you? He said, I'm an employee. I'm a government employee. I went, oh, what's the difference? He says, the difference is an entrepreneur must know about money. Well, then they're no longer entrepreneurs. And he says, an employee doesn't have to know anything about money because the government will take care of, the company will take care of. So I'm all confused. But I took my dad's advice and I trundled over to Mike's father's office and knocked on his door and I said, hey, I'm here, 9 years old. Teach me about money. He says, beat it, kid, you know. But that's where this toy of rich dad poor dad started. And finally, through persistence, my rich dad started teaching me about money on one condition. And that condition was he would never pay me. He says, the moment I pay you, you think like an employee. He says, that's the trap. Entrepreneurs work for free. And now I'm 9 years old, my head's going cracking in half. He says, you never want a paycheck. Understand that, kid. And okay, I got it. And he said, well, how do I make money? He says, that's what entrepreneurs figure out. So how do I learn about money? So he would just break out a Monopoly game board. So I would work for free and pick up cigarette butts and get hotels and restaurants that I would clean and do menial tasks. And as I got older, I started getting into office work and marketing and accounting. I was an apprentice basically, but I always worked for free. And he would teach me about money. But the way he taught me about money was playing Monopoly. And I finally one day I got upset. I said, well, when are you going to teach me about money? He says, what do you think we're doing? We're playing Monopoly. He goes, no. What do you think we're doing? We're playing Monopoly. He says, what do you think we're doing? I don't know. I'm teaching about money. And then that's when, you know, he had one greenhouse. You know, he says, there's many formulas for great success in money. There's thousands of them. But one of the best ones found and gave him Monopoly. Still is today. Four greenhouses, one bed hotel. So what? He says, one of the greatest ways to acquire great wealth is playing Monopoly in real life. Four greenhouses, one bed hotel. Is that all there is? He goes, that's it. And he says, what do you think I'm doing? And I went, I don't know. So then he took me out and he showed me his greenhouses. And 10 years later, when I was 19, I was now in school in New York, and I come back to Hawaii, and Rich Dad had bought the biggest piece of land smack dab in the middle of Waikiki Beach. And when you go to Waikiki Beach today, you'll see the Hyatt Regency Hotel. That was his hotel.
Just like the game of Monopoly.
Just like the game of Monopoly.
Acquired assets, and they became bigger assets.
He just kept, it was called an assemblage, because that property wasn't that big at the time, so he had to buy out all the small guys. Because Waikiki was a little dirt water, a little town. So he'd buy out this shop owner, buy that shop owner. And it took him a while, but he finally assembled this large piece of property. And then he and Hyatt put up this giant hotel.
Mm.
And, it just sold for $800 million. So that's how I learned about money. I've had financial crashes. I've had people stab me in the back. But they're all good because I grow from it. That's spirituality. You know, people who are afraid of making mistakes like they teach in school, they don't ever grow. Because spirituality is as good and as bad. There's right and there's wrong. There's up and there's down. Most people don't want to be right. They only want to be positive. Well, you can't have that. That's not reality. Well, I wasn't poor by most people's standards, but I came from a family with a poor attitude, if you know what I mean. Because rich, poor, middle class, poverty starts with a fundamental attitude. Poverty is passed on. It's taught in your families. And middle class is taught in families. And so the people right now who are sitting at home who are struggling financially.
After 16 years of teaching people how to build email businesses, I finally wrote a book called The Email Edge. It's all
financially or worried about money or unhappy. They may be making a lot of money, but unhappy with what they're doing. It was probably taught to you. You know, your superego was taught, get a job, work hard, or you'll never be rich, or rich or evil, or whatever. So school system will never teach you about money. The school system is designed to teach you to be an employee, which is important, or a doctor or a lawyer, a specialist, but never about money. And what most people lack is real business knowledge, like accounting, you know, like debt, like taxes. You got to know that stuff, but they don't teach it in school to anybody. So, and then when people ask me, how did your rich dad learn this? When your poor dad, a PhD, didn't. And the answer is very simply, my rich dad has been my best friend's father. His father died when he was 13. So our rich dad had this family business at 13 to run. So he had to drop out of school, which was his blessing. You know, there's blessings, and you know, sometimes the blessing doesn't look like a blessing, but it turned out to be a blessing. And then his teachers became his bookkeeper, his accountant, his attorney, his banker, his real estate agents. So he has what I call real teachers, not these fake teachers in school. You see, most teachers in school, they're out of ethics. They teach subjects they themselves don't practice. I asked the teacher, I said, you know, I'm in my third year of calculus now. It was called Strength of Materials. I said, am I ever going to use this stuff? He goes, no. You know, I said, why do you teach it? I was like, I paid. I said, do you ever use it? He goes, no.
Very, very interesting scenario of how we go to school to learn certain things, but not how to make a living. Isn't that interesting? Well, we don't have that much time left. I want to say happy birthday to Dr. Bertram Franklin, who is one of my best friends. I've known Virgil ever since I was like in kindergarten. And we grew up together, played ball with each other, and also played ball against each other. The last presentation that we're going to listen to today is about the 10 richest people in history. Hopefully we'll have enough time to listen to all of it.
Jeff Bezos is viewed by as many as the richest person to have ever walked the earth. However, there are many billionaires and even trillionaires that have come before him. That being said, it can be challenging to estimate the wealth of someone who was born in the 1400s or someone who owned a kingdom. But using the opinions of several different experts, a pretty clear list can be compiled. Today, we're going to take a look at the top 10 richest people of all time and see how they earned their wealth and what exactly they used it for. Number 10, William the Conqueror, $230 billion. When you have the word conqueror in your name, chances are you're going to have quite a few assets. William the Conqueror was born around 1028 and went on to become the first Norman king of England. His estimated fortune reached its height at around $230 billion, a little less than double Jeff Bezos' fortune. So how did he amass such a wealth? Well, his name gives that one away. As one did in England back in the heyday, William earned his fortune by pillaging pretty much everyone. He conquered England in 1066, a conquest that saw the loss of around 100,000 lives. When he was crowned king, he did several things that shifted England. He banned slavery and made everyone in England speak English because he wasn't fluent in English. During his wealthy reign, he had over 500 castles built across England and Wales, and he became one of the largest landowners in England of all time. He was known to eat well and wear fine clothes, so much so that when he passed in 1087, his clothes and jewelry were immediately stripped from his body by looters, leaving him naked. Number 9. Osman Ali Khan, $236 billion. One of the most recent billionaires on our list, Osman Ali Khan was featured on the cover of Time magazine in 1937 as the world's richest person. The last ruler of the princely state in Hyderabad, in India, his wealth was well known. So how wealthy was he exactly? Modern experts estimate that his wealth hovered around $236 billion. But the Guinness Book of World Records claimed that he was worth $750 billion. Unfortunately, we'll have to go with the experts on this one. That being said, Osman Ali Khan lived a life few of us could ever imagine. The Jacob Diamond, which is the fifth biggest polished diamond in the world, was in his constant possession. One might assume he would set it on a ring, or a necklace, or a glass case. But Osman Ali Khan used the precious diamond as a paperweight in his office. But that wasn't the only jewel he owned. He owned a large collection of jewels, known as the Jewels of Nizams, that were passed down from ruler to ruler. His collection included 173 jewels, including 2,000 carat leather emeralds, dozens of pearls, studded necklaces, buckles, earrings, crowns, armbands, and the Satellite, a necklace embedded with 465 pearls. Altogether, the jewels are estimated to be worth $2 billion, only a fraction of his immense wealth. Yet, despite owning such a wealth, living in a massive palace, owning 50 Rolls-Royce vehicles, and having 300 servants, Osman didn't always reflect his financial status. He was known to wear the same hat for nearly his entire life. He ate his food on a tin plate and was known to beg his guests to bum a cigarette. He was even known to knit his own socks. Over the course of his rule, he introduced electricity, airplanes, and railways to the district. He was also known for donating much of his wealth to educational institutions and religious institutions throughout.
Do you like ads? I don't. That's how we created Adamover. It's a product that makes it so you never have.
India. Number 8. Nikolai Romanov. $300 billion. Russia has had its fair share of wealthy families, and the Romanovs are perhaps the most well-known. Unfortunately for them, their wealth is one of the reasons they were massacred. Nikolai Romanov, the last Tsar of Russia, was estimated to have around $300 billion to his name. He's viewed by many modern historians as a weak, incompetent leader, and historians weren't the only ones who felt that way. Nikolai was even credited himself saying, "I am not prepared to be a Tsar. I never wanted to be one. I know nothing of the business of ruling." However, his incompetence and reluctance to be a ruler doesn't mean he didn't enjoy his spoils. He had an annual salary of 200,000 rubles. With an additional 20,000 rubles to spend on clothes and miscellaneous items. However, he constantly overshot that $20,000 limit, often spending an additional 150,000 rubles. For reference, factory workers generous, only made 5,000 rubles, whose spending money was 40 times that of the annual salary of an average worker. So, what exactly did he spend all that money on? Pretty much anything he wanted. He regularly spent 20,000 rubles to have clothes and military uniforms custom made for himself. His wife also joined in on these shopping sprees. She was known to spend 40,000 rubles on extravagant jewelry. Then there are the events that Nikolai spent his money on. His coronation was the most expensive coronation in Russia's history. 24 tons of silver and gold tableware were brought to the event. A choir of 1,200 people were hired to serenade the couple. He loved to throw parties for his country and himself. On the 300th anniversary of the dynasty, he celebrated by pardoning all civil debts and had over 1.5 million gold, silver, and bronze medals made to commemorate the event. In addition, he mass-produced postal stamps, handkerchiefs, and mugs that celebrated the event. Basically, he sent everyone away with winning expensive goodie bags. He was also known for eating extravagant meals and going on lavish trips. His kitchen was manned by 55 people and offered 3 levels of meals. The most simple still included a 4-course breakfast, 5-course lunch, and a 4-course dinner. The food was so upscale that the leftovers were served as delicacies at local restaurants. His trips were most often hunting trips. 50 crew members were brought to make the experience as luxury as possible, and that included painters who would paint scenes from the hunt. His annual hunting budget was equivalent to the yearly salary of 100 school teachers. If that's not extravagant wealth, I don't know what is. Number 7, Andrew Carnegie. $309 billion. When you think of wealthy American families, chances are the Carnegies come to mind. Andrew Carnegie was a steel magnate who went from working in a factory changing spools of thread to having a net worth of $309 billion. He started his early career working as a telegraph messenger. His success, hard work, and attention to detail led him becoming the superintendent of the Western Division of Pennsylvania Railroad by the time he was 24. His superiors at his job taught him about business and influenced investing, which led him to investing a lot of money in the railroad industry right as it began to boom. After the Civil War, Carnegie left the railroad business and went on to develop several ironworks companies, namely Keystone Bridge Works and the Union Iron Works. He also launched the Carnegie Steel Company, which he sold to J.P. Morgan for an astounding $13 billion. His wealth was immense and well-known, but he took a rather modern approach to using it. He wrote a book, The Gospel of Wealth, which discusses the wealthy's social responsibility. His most famous quote, "The man who dies rich dies disgraced," was also practiced by him. He donated the equivalent of $4.8 billion to charities, and upon his death, gave most of it away. He left his family with a small sum of his wealth, and also left sizable amounts to his housekeeper, nurse, main servant, and his butler.
When I was 12, my dad was driving me to school, where we got stopped by the police.
Number 6, Jacob Fugger, $400 billion. Jacob Fugger was one rich fugger. Jokes aside, Jacob Fugger was actually known as Jacob the Rich, and for good reason. He's estimated to have had a fortune of around $400 billion. Back in the good old 1400s, Jacob's parents earned their fortune trading textiles with Italy. When Jacob came of age, he started mining operations for silver, quicksilver, copper, and cinnabar. He had a talent for investing, and he often spread his wealth across many different industries, and it worked out pretty well for him. By the time he had truly made it, he was loaning money out to the Vatican. His money helped build many of the Vatican's buildings, including the Sistine Chapel. He was known to spend his money on some rather lavish things from time to time, and in a period of extreme wealth in Italy, that often meant building homes, art, and fine clothing. His wife greatly benefited from this. At one point in his life, he bought his wife 40,000 guilders worth of jewelry. His own home was 4 stories tall and was, at the time, a modern Renaissance building. There were water fountains and fireplaces in every single room. He was also quite a giver. He funded Fugere, which became the first low-income housing program in the world. There were 52 homes on the property that housed families in difficult situations. The yearly rent was one symbolic guilder, though the residences did have to pray for the Fugger family 3 times per day. Fugere is still standing with residents to this day, and they still only have to pay 1 guilder per year, which equals about 88 cents. There's no word on if they still have to pray American right now, but he's got a long way to go to beat the wealthiest American of all time, John D. Rockefeller. That name should sound familiar to you. The oil tycoon had a fortune of around $400 billion. He founded the Standard Oil Company in 1870, which began to skyrocket in value shortly after. At one point in time, Standard Oil Company controlled 90% of the oil in the United States. His personal wealth became so enormous that his fortune was 2% of the national economy. With all his money, Rockefeller lived an incredibly comfortable life. He owned houses across the United States. Most notably, he owned Tyquit, a 40-home room with views of New York City. The home took 6 years to complete and featured collections of Chinese ceramics and 20th century art. But the Tyquit home was just the beginning. The home was set on an estate that would come to be known as the Pocantico Estate. The estate covered 3,510 acres and included 75 houses, 70 roads, and 9 whole reversible golf courses, outdoor swimming pools, several tennis courts, a full-sized bowling alley, billiard halls, and its own farm and gardens. Rockefeller wasn't well-liked by much of the public, but as he aged, really stepped his philanthropy game up. He donated 10% of his income yearly to charity. Number 4. Akbar I. Akbar I owned a massive empire in the 1500s, and he had quite a fortune too, estimated to have been around $500 billion, though some estimates say he was worth even more. As a direct descendant of Genghis Khan, he had ruling and conquering in his blood. He worked hard from the moment he took the throne to conquer as much territory as possible, tripling it in the size by the end of his rule. Known as the Mughal Empire, his reign stretched across India all the way into northern Afghanistan. He was most known for his religious tolerance, which was most unheard of in the time. Although he was Muslim, many of his closest advisors and the city leaders were Hindu. He took an active role in uniting the two religions and allowing individuals the freedom to choose. He was known for helping translate Hindu literature, and he even took an active role in Hindu festivals. Little is known about how his wealth was spent, but it is known that he had a lot of it. His empire controlled 25% of the world's GDP for years. His palace was said to have exquisite carvings, wall paintings, and extremely rare furniture. Number 3. Augustus.
I've been thinking a lot about my grandparents lately. If they were on their last dollar, they'd give you 50 cents and a tenfold plate to take home. We could use a lot more of that these days. If elected, every day I serve South Carolina in the Senate, the spirit of my grandparents will be serving along with me.
Caesar. Julius Caesar may be more well-known, but his heir, Augustus Caesar, was the rich one. He is the only confirmed true heir in history, owning a fifth of the wealth of the Roman Empire, which accounted for 30% of the world's GDP at the time. Most experts agree his fortune hovered around $4.3 trillion. On top of the wealth his position as emperor brought, much of his fortune came from inheritance. He inherited 75% of Julius Caesar's wealth, and while no one knows exactly how much that is, Julius was known to have left 300 sesterces to every Roman citizen upon his death. At the time, 300 sesterces was worth 4 months' wages, and that barely put a dent in his finances. But it wasn't just Julius who gave Augustus money. Several wealthy families were known to leave part of their estate to the emperor, hoping it would bring political safety to their own children. During his 40-year affluent reign, he doubles the size of the Roman Empire. He founded a standing army, police and fire services, a courier system, and roads, effectively bringing Rome into the modern age. During his life, he lived in a palace now known as the House of Augustus. The House of Augustus featured entire rooms dedicated to art and weapons. Mosaics were said to cover every floor, and frescoes were said to cover every wall. Upon his death, one of the last recorded things he said was, "I found Rome of clay. I leave it to you of marble." Indeed, his...
Wow. It's mind-blowing the amount of money that these particular people were able to mask. We covered a lot of territory today on a lot of different subjects, mainly about money and about wealth and about future projections and future possibilities. You have been listening to Getting It Done, and I have been your host, Dr. Walter Dean. Have a good week, people.